I'm Laura Murphy Oates, and this is The Full Story.
It's a good start. Thank you, everybody, for coming. I declare open this hearing of the COVID-19 Select Committee. As set out in the circulated program today, the committee will hear evidence from the Department of Prime Minister and Cabinet and the National COVID-19 Coordination Commission. Information on procedural...
Over the past few months, a Senate inquiry into the Australian government's COVID-19 response has been hearing from members of the Prime Minister's office and members of a special commission appointed by the PM called the National COVID-19 Commission. Time and time again, questions have been put to them.
Can I go to the issue, coming back to the gas-led recovery?
About gas.
Senator, I don't agree with your terminology of gas-led recovery. The task of the National COVID Commission is to actually look at and accelerate the recovery.
The first report from the task force is essentially on a gas-led recovery for the country. Would it be fair to describe it as a priority for the task force?
Senator, from my attendance at the meetings, I think I would put that as one input into the Commission's job of seeking to accelerate the recovery.
And why this Commission has narrowed in on investment in fossil fuels as a solution to the economic downturn.
Would you be opposed to a renewables-led recovery?
No, the definition of recovery then needs some discussion, I think.
However, when journalists have tried to find out more about how and why this commission has made certain decisions, all too often they've met a dead end. Today, the National COVID-19 Commission and a troubling lack of transparency. It's Thursday, the 13th of August.
I'm recording.
Chris Norse is a transparency reporter for Guardian Australia.
Good to go.
So, Chris, what is this COVID commission and when did it actually get off the ground?
So in late March, it seems like a long, long time ago now, but...
And in many cases in relation to the operation of businesses...
This was when coronavirus really started to sort of bite in Australia.
Some... very difficult changes, which means that they will need to close their doors, and that also means that their staff will no longer be able to turn up to work and have employment.
This is when, you know, the enormity of what we were facing was really starting to make itself apparent. So we had, you know, these huge, huge structural problems that necessitated major policies like JobKeeper, JobSeeker. You know, we were facing potentially economic devastation, mass unemployment, you know, real serious seismic shocks to the Australian economy.
And that's why today I'm announcing the establishment of a National COVID-19 Coordination Commission. That commission's job, put simply, is to solve problems.
And so Morrison at this point announces that he's come up with a special body to try and guide Australia out of its economic crisis. Mm. And that body at that stage was called the National COVID-19 Coordination Commission, or the NCCC.
Problems that require the private sector working together with the private sector. CEOs to talk to CEOs and to be engaged with by CEOs.
And what was the purpose of this commission? What did they say about it?
So on paper, the purpose is to advise the Australian government on ways to sort of mitigate the effects of the coronavirus on Australia's economy, but also to sort of path a way out of the economic crisis that we're currently in.
Whether it's ensuring we get food to supermarkets and we ensure the supply lines remain open there, when the trucks can roll out when they need to roll out, and we have enough of them to do that job at all the right times, these are the many challenges that we need to face.
So that is a really broad remit to be giving to a body like this. There's no sort of formal limitations on what this body can and can't do.
And who was actually appointed to this commission?
So there's a really interesting mix of people who have been handpicked by Scott Morrison. So you've got people like Greg Combey, the former union official, Jane Holton, the former secretary of the health department. But you also have Catherine Tanner, who's an executive with Energy Australia. And, of course, in charge of it all is Nev Power.
Another area, and I'm joined by Neville Power here today. Nev Power, as we know.
So Nev Power is a fairly well-known figure in the mining industry.
Now, Nev Power was the former head of the Fortescue Minerals Group. He has a great experience in doing just this task.
He was the former head of the Fortescue Metals Group, which is a huge global iron ore company.
If you're working in the mining sector, you need to know how to solve problems, and big ones. There are only big issues in the mineral sector.
And at the time that he was appointed to the commission, he was also the chairman of a gas company called Strike Energy.
And it's great that Neville, when I rang him the other day, I simply said, Nev, I need you to serve your country. And he quickly responded. So with that, I'm going to hand you over to Nev, and then we can take some further questions.
Thank you very much, Prime Minister. And
so this commission is announced in March. It's now August. What have they done so far?
Look, they have done some work. So they've played a role in sort of helping businesses plan in dealing with COVID. They've set up a few working groups around things like manufacturing. They've played a role in helping with the supply of PPE. But by far the biggest thing that we've seen from them so far is an interim report that was leaked to the media at the end of May.
What is this interim report? Where does it come from?
So this report comes from the Commission's Manufacturing Task Force. So this is the part of the Commission that is wholly dedicated to helping bolster Australia's manufacturing sector. So that report was known as the Liveris Report, and that was a reference to the head of the Manufacturing Task Force, Andrew Liveris, who was a former Dow Chemical executive, big fossil fuel industry figure. And the interesting thing about this report and what really jumped out to the media and to the public was that it did seem to really emphasise Australia embarking on a gas-led manufacturing recovery. So it proposed things like having the federal government underwrite an increased national gas supply, having government agencies partnering with companies to accelerate development of new gas fields, and having the states introduce subsidy schemes for gas-fired power plants. A big emphasis on gas.
Okay, so the Commission's first big solution, its first big idea to get the economy back on track is all about pushing fossil fuels. How is this report and this idea received?
Well, it's received by people pointing out some very significant shortcomings in that report. So my colleague, the environment editor of The Guardian, Adam Morton, he reported that that plan didn't consider any alternatives to gas, and it didn't consider what happens if, greenhouse gas emissions are cut as promised under the 2015 Paris Climate Agreement, which is a bit of a problem because we know that studies are now showing that gas has much more emissions than we initially thought. And we've got people like Emma Heard, so she's the chief executive of the Investor Group on Climate Change, representing a massive sort of suite of investors who have about $2 trillion in assets. So she says, the task force proposals could expose Australia to future economic shocks, and that effectively billions of dollars in public and private sector investment would be wasted as the rest of the world sort of moves to cut emissions.
Do we know whether these recommendations have been taken seriously by government? Have they been taken up in terms of policy?
Look, we don't know in terms of, the specific policy measures that the government may or may not have adopted. But what we do know is that there is a really kind of strong backing within government of gas and gas's potential to try and drive Australia back into a period of economic stability. So we know that, Scott Morrison has strongly backed gas. We know Angus Taylor, who's the Energy and Emissions Reductions Minister, has argued for a gas-fired recovery from the pandemic. So in that sense, this issue of gas really is becoming quite important in the national conversation at a government level about how Australia recovers from the pandemic. And it's important to note that this is against the advice of many experts, and this debate is really quite a contentious one, both within our national politics and the broader debate about energy policy generally. For example, Tony Wood, the Energy Program Director at the Grattan Institute, which is by no means a left-wing organisation, he says that he believes that gas is likely to play a role, but that it should be left to live or die on its own merits and not be boosted or propped up by the government. He's also been very dismissive of the idea of long-distance gas pipelines, which is one of the ideas that's sort of championed by Nev Power.
Has anyone else expressed concern about this focus on gas by the COVID Commission?
So a few weeks after the report was leaked and became public, you had people who were in on the discussions really kind of sounding the alarm about, you know, the tenor of those discussions. So Paul Bastian, who's the head of the Australian Manufacturing Workers Union, he's also a member of the Commission's Manufacturing Task Force, so he was in the room. He was saying, you know, that gas had completely dominated the task force discussions, with renewable energy playing a much smaller role.
Okay, so what you've got, according to Paul Bastian, is gas leading this discussion around economic recovery. And you've got two prominent figures on this commission, Liveris and Nev Power, with ties to the gas industry. Surely this is a bit of a problem. This has prompted some sort of concern.
Yeah, look, this has really been the focal point for a lot of questions about the commission.
Great. Thank you very much, Mr. Power. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Senator Patterson. Senator Watt.
Thanks, Chair. Can you hear me okay there?
Yes, perfectly.
Great. Okay. Thanks, Mr. Power. I've only just joined the hearings, but hopefully I'll be covering things that you've already been asked this morning.
This week there's been a Senate inquiry about the government's response to COVID, and Nev Power was actually called up to speak about this.
Maybe this is one for you, Mr. Power.
And it was put to him pretty squarely by Labor Senator Murray Watt.
I haven't seen as much talk about renewables being part of that manufacturing future.
He asked him, did you guys consider other options other than gas? Did you consider renewables, for example?
Does the commission consider that whatever manufacturing revitalisation we can have in Australia could be powered by both gas and renewables, or is it an exclusively gas-based approach that the commission favours?
Thank you, Senator. There were a number of areas that were addressed in the advanced manufacturing group, and one of those was energy-intensive manufacturers.
Australia. Now, Power's response is that, yes, they did consider other options, but they did preference gas, and the reason for that was because
Australia has a very large pipeline of private investment in renewable generation, but a very small pipeline in investment in storage and firming, because that those technologies are not as well advanced and they are relatively very expensive and very difficult to install.
But more broadly, this whole issue has, I guess, prompted a lot of questions about whether there is a conflict that exists within the commission, you know, perceived or otherwise.
Mm.
So, you know, from the outside, there is a fair perception, I think, that there is a tension between now their two roles. One is a taxpayer-funded advisor who is helping shape government policy. And then on the other side of the coin, their role as a business person. And, you know, I think that is where we get to the question of how is this commission dealing with those potential conflicts of interest?
Next, the lack of transparency around this COVID-19 commission. Right, so how does the government usually deal with this when they have conflicts of interest? Because surely they have people from the business sector advise them on policy fairly often.
Yeah, it does crop up quite often. I mean, there are plenty of advisory bodies, you know, of this type that provide advice to the government. And you do have mechanisms around it to sort of ensure that conflicts are dealt with properly. So in a normal situation, when a conflict of interest arises, so when someone is potentially making a decision or providing advice on something to government that may conflict with their private interests, what we'd see is real kind of transparency around that. So we'd see declarations of those conflicts We'd see people recuse themselves from discussions or decision-making processes where that conflict may arise. And we'd also see a really clear set of rules and codes dictating how those conflicts must be managed.
Right. So if you're like a mining exec, you wouldn't go to the meeting about the mining industry on the commission that you're on, ideally, right?
Right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And if you were, you'd have to declare precisely what your interest is. You'd have to make it really clear that, you know, you have this private interest that, you know, could sort of colour your judgment on whatever it is you're talking about.
Okay. And what have we seen happen with the NCCC?
With the NCCC, things are very opaque. So we do know that there is a requirement for the commissioners to fill out a conflict of interest declaration form and also to declare conflicts during meetings. The real problem here is that this body is so new, it's so unlike anything that we've used in the past, that we actually don't know how the conflicts are being otherwise managed. So it's impossible for us to see what conflicts have been declared, whether they've all been properly declared. And we also don't know that the usual sort of rules and codes that apply to normal public service departments, for example, are being applied to this commission.
So just to clarify, the NCCC has said that the commissioners have declared their conflict of interest, but the public or journalists have just not been able to see them.
That's exactly right. So journalists and not-for-profits have all tried through Freedom of Information Law to get a look at these declarations to see what has been declared and how it's been managed. And it's just been impossible, absolutely impossible. No one has been able to get those conflict of interest documents out of that commission.
Is there a legitimate reason that you can think of that the commission would keep these conflict of interest declarations private?
Well, according to the Prime Minister, there is a reason to keep them private. So Morrison's department has told the Senate committee that the declarations are provided in confidence and that they contain sensitive personal information about themselves and, in some cases, members of their immediate family. So they argue that, you know, the disclosure of these interests may unreasonably infringe on the privacy of these commissioners.
Okay, so they've been pretty opaque about what these conflicts of interest are, but they say that they've handled it internally. Do we know what that looks like? How have they handled this when creating things like this interim report?
Yeah, so Nev Power, so the head of the commission, he goes to great lengths to sort of distance himself from this interim report. He said it was, you know, a very early draft.
The leaked report, Senator, doesn't reflect the views of the commission. It was an interim report, and I can't recall whether we'd seen it at all or whether it was in very early draft and presentation.
And he also says that he had since stepped aside from his position as deputy chair of Strike Energy, the gas company.
It became apparent, though, that because of perceived conflicts of interest, I don't believe there are any areas where I have breached any public interest or conflict of interest rules, but there has been perceptions of it raised, and so as a result of that, I elected to stand down from those two boards. I still retain.
So, you know, he's come out and really tried to put himself at arm's length from this interim report for quite obvious reasons. However, during an appearance before the Senate committee, he did say that he hadn't recused himself from the commission's discussions about developing gas.
Thank you. So what I'm asking, Mr. Power, is have you stepped back from all discussions regarding any gas projects with the NCCC?
No, I haven't.
Which is slightly concerning.
Thank you,
Senator Patrick. Thank you, Senator.
As for Liveris, evidence given at the inquiry shows that he had also been required to make a conflict of interest declaration.
So, Chris, as you've outlined, we have this group of business leaders who are making recommendations to the government about how to recover from the COVID-19 crisis. And there's just been an incredibly frustrating lack of information about how this body works and how they're making these decisions. I mean, how big a departure is this from good governance, from how, you know, our democracy is supposed to work?
Well, look, from the experts that I've spoken to, there is a significant problem here. So a paper was published quite recently by the University of Melbourne, which found the commission suffered from a number of flaws. One of those was a lack of transparency. Another was a lack of proper accountability and governance measures. And it also warned that there is a real risk here of executive expansion. Now, they said that basically all of this means that the commission poses what is really an enduring risk to Australian democracy and must be overhauled.
So a risk to democracy is a pretty big claim. Let's break down some of the reasons that they give for this. What about transparency? How transparent has this commission been?
Well, not very at all. We know that the Prime Minister's department, who is fielding FOI requests for the commission, has been quite hesitant to either release documents or to fully release documents. So what I'm saying there is they're either knocking back FOI requests or they're redacting really critical parts of the documents that they do release. So various FOIs have asked for documents about its discussion of gas projects, about the way that conflicts of interests were handled. And what we've seen is the department just simply refusing those requests, usually because they're saying, look, those requests are too big and they're going to take too much work for us to process. But they've also redacted documents on economic and national security grounds, which I think is particularly interesting.
As a transparency reporter, this level of redactions, this level of knockbacks of FOIs around, you know, a central advisory body, how common is this? Do you see this happen? Have you seen this happen before?
Yeah, look, so, I mean, I think most people would understand that the government more generally has a transparency problem and that FOI law in Australia is broken. But here it's kind of particularly galling because this body already has such a, you know, notable lack of transparency. And then for the government to repeatedly knock back FOI requests asking for what are really important documents to the Australian public because they tell us how this country is going to be kind of charted out of economic crisis. I mean, it's just, you know, it's just another example of the real difficulty that we have with this body, its openness and its transparency. And I think just having that level of rejection on FOI requests is just another problem and another reason why critics are so concerned about its operation.
And what does that lead to, this unchecked power, this lack of oversight for these types of bodies?
I mean, the difficulty that we have here is that if something like this is allowed to become the norm, then it represents a real shift to giving more power to the executive and more power, you know, more of an expansion for the executive. So
what do you mean by executive?
So here we're talking about the executive as in, you know, ministers and the prime minister. It sort of gives them the power to handpick really the heads of a commission like this without the usual sort of independent appointment process, without the usual sort of mechanisms of transparency and independence. In a way, sort of bypass the usual accountability structures and rules that govern the public service and create a body that then gives it advice, which it can then act on. So there's a real kind of shift, I guess, to centralising power to the executive through bodies like this. And, you know, the experts that I've spoken to say we can understand that to a degree in a time of crisis, but the difficulty then becomes whenever we move out of crisis, what we see is that governments really want to kind of hold on to structures like this. And that's something we need to be really careful of.
To that end. Now, moving to the purpose of today's announcement, I'm pleased to announce that the COVID Coordination Commission, as it was known when it was first set up, As I said, we are re-establishing that commission and drawing together some new members who we believe will give it a broader spectrum of experience and expertise.
So we've had this big interim report come out from this body. What can we expect from it going forward? What is its role going to be, and what are they even working on right now?
Yeah, so the role of the commission has actually changed slightly. So as of late July, it has been formally titled an advisory board. And so Scott Morrison has said, you know, it won't be an external agency. It will work within government and can form part of the cabinet deliberative processes, which is an important innovation, he says. We've also seen some changes around its membership. So Craig Combe has left, so has Catherine Tanner from Energy Australia. But we've also seen a bunch of new members. We've got Mike Hurst, who's a retired career banker. We've got the former Chief Financial Officer of Transurban, who's Samantha Hogg. And we've got a rural and regional advocate, Sue McCluskey, food franchise entrepreneur, Bao Hong, and Indigenous businesswoman, Laura Berry. And KPMG partner and former union official, Paul Howes. That's quite a significant change to the membership of this body. It's added in some new voices, and it will be very interesting to see how those changes sort of affect the commission's focus going forward. Will it kind of reduce the emphasis on gas? We're yet to see.
Does this change to an advisory board indicate that this is going to be a long-term thing, that this group will continue to advise government from this government and beyond, possibly?
Look, I mean, it certainly sets it up in that way. So it's a real reframing of the image, I guess, of this body to be an advisory board, which is something that's probably a lot more palatable to the general public going forward. So it could be that the Morrison government sees a longer term role for this commission, but really we're kind of yet to see. We're yet to see any real evidence of its contribution, but that being said, you know, it could play a valuable role. I mean, we are in a time of particular crisis. We do need, you know, a diverse range of voices trying to give advice to the government about how we could, you know, recover economically. But everything we've talked about here, transparency, you know, the management of conflicts, making sure that is accountable to the public and accountable to government, all of those things are going to be critical if it is going to play, you know, a good role in Australia's recovery, and that it's not subverted for some other purpose, whether that's to lead and champion a gas-centred recovery or whether it's something else, you know. There is value in this body, but it does need to have proper checks and balances and transparency around it, I think, to properly work.
Okay, Chris, thanks so much.
Thanks, Laura.
We reached out to the Department of Prime Minister and Cabinet for comment about some of the allegations in this episode. They state that the National COVID-19 Commission Advisory Board is subject to appropriate governance protocols and processes. These include mechanisms whereby NCC members make declarations about their private interests and relationships to PM&C, and a review of NCC members' potential for conflicts of interest at the start of each NCC meeting, as is the practice for company boards. Where a potential conflict might arise, appropriate arrangements will be put in place, such as recusal of the affected NCC members from specific deliberations. Each NCC member has provided an undertaking not to make improper use of information they obtain in the course of their official duties as an NCC member, or otherwise use their position as an NCC member in order to gain advantage for themselves or for any other person. That's it for today. Thanks to Chris Norse for his time. You can read his reporting and much more Guardian reporting on the COVID-19 Commission at theguardian.com, and we put some links on the full story page. This episode was produced by Ellen Lee Vita and Joe Koning. Our executive producers are Miles Martignoni and Gabrielle Jackson. If you liked this episode, don't forget to leave a rating or a review. Okay, catch you tomorrow.